From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the ban on same-sex marriage continues to lose ground across the nation. And the question is, will Texas buck that trend?
It is a clear and direct attack on the definition of marriage as it is, and it always has been.
Enough talk already. Let's get to voting in the primaries. Early voting begins on Tuesday.
At the moment, it kind of feels like it's going to be low turnout, which means that it may be even meet more pro-Tea Party.
And with so many candidates running on platforms of getting tough on the border, how do border residents feel about that? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week, we saw two more states join the growing list of states unable to support their ban on same-sex marriage. A federal judge on Thursday evening declared that Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage was unconstitutional. And in Kentucky, another southern state, a federal judge ruled that the state must honor same-sex marriages legally performed in other states. But the ruling did not address Kentucky's own ban on such marriages. That issue was not before the court that day. But it was in Texas on Wednesday that the latest skirmish in the culture wars over same-sex marriage came to a San Antonio federal courtroom. I attended the hearing, and after 2 hours of legal arguments about the constitutionality of the Texas ban, there was no decision from the bench. There were essentially two different stages for the debates on the same-sex marriage question, one in the courtroom, where recordings are not allowed, and one on the courthouse steps, where recordings are ubiquitous. In the post-hearing media flurry, Jonathan Sines, president of Texas Values, stood in front of a banner declaring that a child needs a mother and a father. Sines told the cameras that he saw no reason why the state of Texas should lose this historic case.
On this issue, it's very clear that the Texas Constitution, the Texas law, stands for the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman. We fully expect to have victory on this issue ultimately, if not today, in the near future. And no matter what happens with this federal judge, this battle will not be over. We know the other side will appeal. And if for some reason this federal judge inserts himself and strikes down our Texas constitutional amendment and goes against the will of the people, this battle will continue on. And Texans, as you would expect, will ultimately win this battle on the issue of marriage.
Two same-sex couples brought the challenge to the state's ban on same-sex marriage, a male couple and a female couple. And during the hearing, U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia took an interactive role as he peppered both sides of the issue with questions about the Texas ban on same-sex marriage. Garcia asked the attorneys for the two same-sex couples looking to be married in Texas what actual harm they have suffered from the state. Attorney Neil Lane explained that they were not able to have the legal protections that heterosexual couples have. Names are left off birth certificates and death certificates. Assistant Texas Solicitor General Michael Murphy defended the ban and said this is not a constitutional question, but a political issue. And he pointed to the 2005 referendum in which 76% of Texan voters approved the ban into law. After the hearing, attorney for the plaintiffs, Barry Chasnoff, explained there was another election that gave Americans the right of equal protection under the law.
I think it's interesting that the state points out that the voters approved a constitutional ban in 2005. The voters also, throughout the entire nation, approved a constitutional amendment, the 14th, in 1868, that provides for equal protection of all. And that provision in the U.S. Constitution trumps anything that Texas does and requires specifically that Texas grant its citizens equal protection. So what stings is that they use a local action here to try to suggest that that would somehow or another trump our constitutional rights.
Chasnoff also rejected the state's argument that states' rights allow it to define marriage.
State rights is the oldest argument made any time there's not a really good basis for doing something. They say, oh, the state has the right to do it. As I said, the state used to think it had a right to segregated schools. The state used to think it had a right to prohibit blacks and Hispanics from juries. Those are not state rights, and the state does not have a right to unconstitutionally limit same-sex couples from marrying the people they love.
During the hearing, the state also argued that Texas does not prevent anyone from getting married. They only must marry someone of the opposite sex. Attorney Lane had a pithy response for that, which he repeated on the courthouse steps.
Well, what I said was the state says that the law leaves gays and lesbians free to marry, just not marry someone of the same sex. And that's equivalent to saying, holding someone's head underwater and saying, you're free to breathe. You're just not free to breathe air.
Mark Ferris is one of the plaintiffs looking to overturn the ban.
And, you know, and it all boils down to, I think what they were trying to say was that we're trying to redefine marriage. But I don't think that's true. I think that marriage is something that is two people who are committed to each other, who love each other, and want to demonstrate that commitment. And I think that is really what the tradition of marriage is about.
But Social Conservative Science says they are trying to change what constitutes a marriage in Texas.
I mean, at one point, the homosexual advocates advocating for their side said that this issue, that they were not trying to redefine marriage. That is not true. This entire effort is an effort to redefine marriage and is a clear and direct attack on the definition of marriage as it is and it always has been.
There is no timetable for when the ruling will be handed down, but it will be immediately appealed and sent to the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, and then possibly to the U.S. Supreme Court. Early voting in the Texas primaries begins on Tuesday. It'll run through Friday, February 28th. Actual primary day is Tuesday, March 4th. But for the last several months, candidates have been crisscrossing the state looking for interested party voters to persuade, and they've been raising money and spending most of it on airtime to run their 30-second political ads. But for all their efforts, how informed are the voters about the candidates and how many people will actually vote in the primaries? Texas has a track record of having the lowest voter turnout in the nation, and due to the non-competitive nature of our general election situation, that means the few who do vote in the primaries essentially get to pick the state leaders. Harvey Kronberg is the editor of the online political newsletter, The Quorum Report. He says even if the outlandish notion of pushing back the primary to give voters more time to get up to speed would take place, it wouldn't make much of a difference.
Well, I'm not sure that it would produce any more informed voters because, with rare exceptions, nobody down ballot is talking about anything, certainly on the Republican side, other than metaphors and socially conservative issues. There's very little conversation about the real issues facing the state of Texas.
Right. So all of the candidates are running against Obamacare and illegal immigration.
Essentially. And there may be an occasional conversation about gay marriage and end of life. And at least for the last 15 or 17 years, the only election that has really counted has been the Republican primary statewide. So the fact that we are having such a limited conversation for people that have a better than even shot of becoming the future statewide office holder is obviously disappointing.
Let's talk about the Republican primary for the attorney general.
Yes.
Like you just said, whoever wins that primary, I mean, that's pretty good bet they're going to get the office. And we've got three candidates, Barry Smitherman, Ken Paxton, Dan Branch, and average voter. Do they know who they're voting for?
The mantra this session or this cycle has been that there's only one voter that counts in the Republican Party. It's as if there was a homogeneous Tea Party vote. The battle has been to put trade association endorsements and your kind of more typical endorsements in second place and to try and score endorsements from local Tea Party groups and attend Tea Party forums. We'll see how large the turnout is this election cycle, but typically the larger the primary, the less influence the activists actually have. So there may be a miscalculation here.
Miscalculation would be what?
The miscalculation is that having this one-dimensional conversation in which Obama is the only centerpiece argument is actually persuasive. Nobody, for instance, has talked about the child support division inside the Attorney General's office or the consumer fraud division or any of their priorities in environmental matters. Now, I understand those are not automatically Republican issues, but they haven't even emerged in political debates where people have an opportunity to ask questions. So we have no clue what the priorities are other than to continue the current attorney general's mantra. I get up every day, I go to work, I sue Obama, I go home. And it's one-dimensional and, frankly, somewhat silly.
But it seems like they are promising to be Greg Abbott, but more Greg Abbott.
Greg Abbott on steroids. That's correct. And it's clear the president is not popular in Texas, and it is an organizing principle. But even when they've had exchanges with each other, it is who can torque the same two or three themes more strongly. Generally speaking, the kind of conventional wisdom is Dan Branch is the professionals candidate, Ken Paxton's the grassroots candidate, and Smitherman will pull from Houston, which the Harris, the greater Houston area, which is the where he's from, and which has probably the largest pool of primary voters.
Because there is no one person who's running away with this from right now, it looks like. Well, you think we'll get a runoff?
Statistically, in a three-way race with this one and with folks having such a low awareness of who the candidates are other than their TV spots, it's a better than even shot that we're going to have runoffs in pretty much everything but the governor's race.
The Comptroller for Public Accounts, very important position. It's not about fighting Obamacare because that's not the job. It's about the bookkeeping for the state of Texas. Susan Combs not running for reelection, but she kind of made a mess of things. So people are they're running on being not Susan Combs.
No, they're not even doing that. Here you actually do have some candidates that are talking on the Republican primary that are talking about distinctively different things. With State Senator Glenn Hager, he is essentially trying to ride to the nomination on his social conservative credentials and the fact that he was the author of the recent abortion bill that actually propelled Wendy Davis to fame, but has talked very little about the functions and duties of the comptroller's office. State Representative Harvey Hildebrand, on the other hand, has actually put out a 10- or 12-point program that talks about what his priorities are inside the comptroller's office, and as a result, has probably secured most of the Business Trade Association endorsements, a surprising number anyway. And then finally, there's Deborah Medina, who has the highest name ID of all of them, who is running on a very clear platform of trying to eliminate property taxes, something that she's been advocating now for a decade, and for a more smoothly functioning comptroller's office. It's ironic that we have more clarity on positions in an office that is typically associated with accounting than we do with the attorney general's office or the lieutenant governor's office, where actual a major public policy is developed.
So the big race has been lieutenant governor. That's been covered a lot. But does the average, do they know who they're voting for?
I don't really think the average voter does know who they're voting for. The highest name ID candidate in the race, of course, is the incumbent, David Dewhurst, followed at the moment by Dan Patrick, who today just released a television ad in which he essentially relays his Christian credentials. And then somewhere after that is Land Commissioner Jerry Patterson and Agriculture Commissioner Todd Staples. Patterson is a fairly known commodity in Republican primary circles, having been around for a long time and authored the concealed carry bill and the motorcycle helmet bill. But none of them seem to be breaking out. The conventional wisdom is that it will be a runoff between between David Dewhurst and Dan Patrick. However, there is a group of business folks in Houston, which is Patrick's base, which were very disappointed in the fact that he voted against the budget, that he didn't support, does not seem to support infrastructure development, which business badly needs. And has started a website and will begin running commercials this weekend, radio commercials and perhaps TV commercials, to drive his negatives up. So the presumption of who will be in that runoff is somewhat murky at this stage.
You're describing basically an anti-Dan Patrick pack. It's like anyone but Patrick. They've and they're putting money behind it.
That is correct. Senator Patrick distinguished himself in some ways in this last legislative session as chairman of public education, but he surprised everybody on the floor of the Senate at the last minute by voting against a budget that had in it things, any number of things that he had asked for. And the forget the socially conservative issues. The chambers of commerce in the state of Texas want better roads. They want a more reliable electric grid. They want sustainable water supplies. And when you vote against the budget out of the blue, when you've had a chance to negotiate it, this particular group of business people decided that they could not trust him to be an honest broker and are putting resources behind in anybody but Patrick movement.
Looking at the debate of the lieutenant governor's candidates, they seemed that they were running for who would be the person who would violate the Constitution the hardest.
It was revealing in the sense that there was virtually no nuance. Everybody was, with the exception of Commissioner Patterson, was essentially giving the same answer phrased differently. But the questions were essentially about end of life, about abortion, maybe term limits. None of the things that are going to in any way impact the daily lives of Texans. And we came out with a fairly unclear vision of what any of these folks would want to do were they in office.
But with so much animus towards Dan Patrick from different parts of the state, if he and Dewhurst get into a runoff, which is what some people are predicting, then will we see people will get behind Dewhurst who have been reluctant to do so thus far?
Of course, there is a strong anti-incumbent sentiment inside the Republican Party, but let's remember that the last person to beat David Dewhurst was Ted Cruz, and Dan Patrick had a major confrontation with Ted Cruz when he was running. He had him on his radio show, and they got into a virtual shouting match as Patrick was essentially defending David Dewhurst. Somewhat ironically, at this stage of the game, the Cruz supporters, as a result, the Cruz supporters have taken a second look at Patrick, and it would be, if it does prove to be a Dewhurst-Patrick confrontation, I would not automatically assume that the Cruz voter would automatically go over to the Dan Patrick camp.
For the governor, of course, Greg Abbott, we've been calling him the presumed nominee. Because there's three other candidates running against for that nomination, but it doesn't look like, no one has a chance, right?
Right.
There's a Cecede Kilgore. He's on there.
He is still on the ballot. Of course, anything can happen in a primary, but there is no polling that shows any threat to Attorney General Greg Abbott, the presumptive front runner. He has, frankly, whether you agree with his message or not, he's run a very good campaign. And so he's been all over the state. He's reached out. He's been visible, frankly, among most of the Republican statewide candidates. He's been the warmest personality. And it's hard for me to see that he would be in any jeopardy.
With Wendy Davis, the presumptive Democratic nominee, you can't say that. I mean, it is just like she's doing herself more harm.
The more charitable way to put that is probably that she's had some major missteps. But let's remember that Greg Abbott has run, I don't know, a half a dozen statewide campaigns in his career and has spent the last 3 years building a political organization. And Wendy Davis had the same problem, and has the same problem in a sense that Mitt Romney had, and that is that you try and build a political organization much later than your opponent is building one. They've made some very critical mistakes, but this is February, and other than people who live and breathe politics, the general voter is not paying attention yet. And the narrative that's going to decide the outcome of this election probably really won't crystallize until the latter part of the summer. So in a sense, there's a lot of folks in both political parties that think these missteps at the beginning of her campaign were actually a gift, because there's really nothing that trains you for a statewide campaign like burning your fingers and having to readjust.
there were a lot of supporters who were really counting on her for being a transformational candidate, because she has to be a transformational candidate in order to beat the numbers as we see them right now. And as she makes mistakes about coming out in favor of open carry, because that's not going to earn her a single Republican vote. People are wondering who is Wendy Davis?
Well, first of all, I think it neutralizes a Republican attack. It doesn't win her a Republican vote, but it also probably does not divert a single Democratic vote. It just takes that issue off the table, removes that chess piece from the game. The coalition that she is going to have to build is going to be the same coalition that Barack Obama built in the states where he was successful, which is women, minorities, and millennials, with some male crossover, white male crossover. The issues that are going to make a difference there for women, obviously, it is women's health, which has obviously been the subject of some controversy. And even anecdotally, diehard Republican women I know were stunned at some of the things that have happened in the legislature the last couple of years. Minorities, just as we were discussing in the lieutenant governor's debate, there is virtually nothing that the Republican Party has done that can overcome the message being sent by the candidates, which is very hostile to minorities. Even if the top leadership understands that the future of the Republican Party is going to depend on minority participation, socially conservative issues have no appeal to millennials. Now, whether that turns them out or not remains to be seen. But those are going to be the themes that drive people to the polls for Wendy Davis, not anything related to handguns.
But is there anything in the Democratic primary to be watching for?
Well, the most interesting race at this stage is obviously the Agriculture Commission race, which has the former mayor of El Paso pitted against Kinky Friedman. Kinky Friedman, I've seen in some recent interviews, is actually, he's still a humorist, but he is no longer satisfied with just being a joke. And in an age of Colorado and Washington State, it may sound funny, but running on, he may end up being the surrogate referendum on decriminalization or legalization. And frankly, that's his most fundamental likelihood of being successful in that race.
But it would be about marijuana. He's trying to say, vote for me is a vote for marijuana.
Yes, a vote for me is a vote for legalization is what he's saying. He's essentially running on the two C's, casinos and cannabinols. Cannabinols being the scientific term for the active ingredient in marijuana. Casinos and marijuana. Both of those have large majority support in the broader November electorate. Remains to be seen whether they have sufficient support to mobilize to get Friedman across the finish line in his Agricultural Commission race.
All right. So, what do you think the turnout's going to be?
At one point, I thought this was going to be a substantial turnout on the Republican side, maybe in the neighborhood of 1.5, 1.6 million. But the kind of one-dimensional, very narrowly targeted messages that are coming to Republican primary voters where there are competitive races is not a broad appeal kind of message. And I think it's going to make the election far less interesting. There are some down-ballot races, ironically, that might drive some legislative and legislative races that may drive turnout, but at the moment it kind of feels like it's going to be low turnout, which means that it may be even meet more pro Tea Party, which again could create opportunities for Democrats if the Republican Party is perceived as radicalized as a result of their primary. It creates opportunities for Democrats, and of course who knows whether they can capitalize on them.
Harvey Kronberg is the editor of the Quorum Report, an online newsletter that covers Texas politics. It's on the web at quorumreport.com. Early voting begins Tuesday at 7 a.m. for the Texas primaries. Many of the candidates running for Republican nominations are running ads about their plans to get tough on the border. And those ads have also been running in the border region of Texas. Groups on the border say these ads are sending them a negative message that's not connected to their actual lives. Martha Sanchez is an organizing coordinator in the Rio Grande Valley for LUPE, which is the group La Union del Pueblo Entero.
Well, I think that the common message from all the politicians right now around this time, where they use immigration, they use the immigrants, they use the border region. It's a political tool. Unfortunately, a lot of the people that use the border region or they use the immigrants for a political game, they really don't have any conversations. They really don't have they don't really know any immigrants. They don't really don't live in the border. They really don't know what life in the border is about. And so they usually remove from this area. They don't really have even friendships. They don't visit with the communities that live in this region. If they come, they come to a very particular area, to a very fancy place, usually to raise money to the country club or something like that. But they usually do not visit the communities there really and here every single day dealing with this issue of immigration, of dealing with the issue of poverty in the colonias and how we dealing with the extra security, with the extra DPS that they try to put here when that's not necessary because without a highway, the colonias don't have highways. This is not the needs that we have.
Y'all live on the border. This is where you live. And so you experience these issues. And of course, y'all want to have border security too, I imagine. But wouldn't y'all, are y'all actually part of the conversation? Do candidates talk to you about what can we do to improve border conditions and border security?
No, we have never been taken consideration or any, there have never been any conversations. I think the less time that we actually even, it was a reference to us, it was when the less time that they sent all the DPS here with they put 18 checkpoints in here. And we are very vocal, so we know that people know about us because we've been very vocal against that when they came and interrupt the life of the border region. And so we know that people know that we exist, but they don't really take us in consideration when they really make a decision of asking or trying to use more money or to try to appear tough. Using the border region as a tool it's a political game to try to appear tough, that they're going to be tougher in crime, and for that they're asking for more money for the region when there is not the needs that we have because there is no such a conversation with us.
We hear a lot of talk from the Republican Party that they want to somehow get more Latinos to join the Republican Party. Do you think that, though, when they talk about the border in such negative ways, does that hurt that effort?
Well, definitely doesn't reflect the needs of the Latino population. When they are talking about what they think we need without any conversation with us, definitely reflects that it's a lot of distance between us and that there is a lack of really knowledge or what do the Latino community really need. That we're going to put our vote on the people that reflect our needs and respond to our needs. And if our needs are not being respected or even addressed, then we're less likely going to be enticed to join any party that is not responding to the needs.
Martha Sanchez is an organizing coordinator in the Rio Grande Valley for the group LUPE. She is reacting to the many candidates running for office with a platform of getting tough on the border. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. You can also find us on iTunes and tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.